Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining today's call. I'm Jim Doyle from Business Forward, and I'll be moderating our conversation today. Currently, all lines are in listen-only mode. We're pleased to welcome Robert Litterman, a founding partner of Kepos Capital, an investment advisory firm. Bob is one of the leading experts on climate risk. Prior to joining Kepos, he spent 23 years at Goldman Sachs, where he served in research, risk management, and investment leadership roles. Prior to Goldman Sachs, he taught at MIT and worked at the Federal Reserve Bank. He's here to discuss market solutions to reducing carbon emissions and how experts view and measure climate change risk. This is going to be an interactive briefing, so after the presentation, we'll have time for questions. For those of you who are new to our programming, Business Forward organizes local roundtables, Washington fly-ins, conference calls, webinars, and media trainings for more than 100,000 local business leaders across the United States. At these briefings, entrepreneurs, investors, small business owners, and executives get the chance to brief policymakers on issues affecting their businesses and tell Washington how Washington can do a better job of working with business and growing our economy. To date, more than 600 mayors, governors, members of Congress, and senior administration officials have participated in our programming, and this is all thanks to the support of more than 60 of America's largest and most respected companies. Before we get started, I'd like to cover a couple of housekeeping items. First, there'll be time for questions and comments. You can participate in two ways. First, you can press 1 on your dial pad at any time to be entered into the queue to ask your question live. Or you can email your question to us at info@businessforward.org. That's info@businessfwd.org, and I'll read aloud. If you are sending a question in or introducing yourself, please include your name, business, and where you're from. And we'll try to get as many questions as we can. Finally, this call is on the record, and there may be reporters present. With that, let's get started. Bob, if you could just start with a discussion of risk management and climate change and the carbon tax proposals that are so popular right now.
Sure. Well, thank you, Jim, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today. And I'd like to thank the Partnership for Responsible Growth, which arranged for me to participate here. George Frampton and his partners, Walt Minnick and Bill Eco, have taken me to many meetings on Capitol Hill and with representatives and their staff and tried to educate me about the policy process in Washington, as I have over the years tried to sound an alarm about the risk of climate change. My background is as an economist and risk manager on Wall Street, and I was head of risk management at Goldman Sachs for many years. But in the last 10 years or so, I've really been focused on climate risk and bringing some of the lessons of risk management from Wall Street to this arena. I've joined the board of the Climate Leadership Council, which is a group I'll talk a little bit about, and I'm also on the boards of a number of environmental groups, such as the World Wildlife Fund and Resources for the Future. So let me start by simply making the observation that the risk of climate change is not currently being priced. Therefore, globally, humans are taking too much risk. This sad reality is a risk management nightmare, which thankfully I think is about to change. Now, I'm sure you're all aware that carbon emissions increase the risk from climate change, and thus there should be appropriate incentives to reduce those emissions. Not including such incentives in the tax code is a serious risk management failure. It's a bug in that code, and like bugs in computer code, once understood, it can and should be fixed immediately. Instead, many governments, in particular the United States, is wasting time, valuable time, which is leading to a very risky emissions path, which in an expected sense creates enormous unnecessary societal costs. To put it simply, the atmosphere is a reservoir with an unknown but limited capacity to safely absorb emissions. Ask yourself, where would you guess is the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that would lead to a tipping point, a point of no return with unknown but potentially catastrophic consequences? Where does that happen? Does it happen at 500 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere or 600 parts per million? No one knows. And that uncertainty is a frightening reality. whatever remaining capacity exists, it is a scarce resource, and by not pricing emissions, we are wasting that remaining capacity. What is incredibly obvious to me as an economist who spent a career in risk management at Goldman Sachs is that it is time to price emissions appropriately. It is time to slam on the brakes. We don't know how much time we have. Now, thankfully, outside the United States, incentives to reduce emissions are being rapidly put in place in China, in India, in Europe. And when the United States implements a significant carbon tax, which I think will happen within 1 or 2 years, there will likely be a convergence across countries to impose significant global incentives to reduce emissions. Now, the imposition of appropriate incentives to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, I think, will rapidly lead to what I would call a phase change in the global economy. With incentives set appropriately, economic agents, consumers, businesses, entrepreneurs, investors, will all make the right decisions. Consumption, production, research, investment will all be appropriate and will be directed appropriately by prices in free markets. These incentives will stimulate investment in the low-carbon infrastructure of the future, and they will rapidly reduce emissions, hopefully, and I think most likely, soon enough to avoid that potential catastrophic outcome. These incentives will also change the valuations of all assets, but in particular, they will negatively impact the valuations of what I would refer to as stranded assets, for example, coal and expensive sources of oil. I think the valuations of those assets do not build in appropriate pricing of emissions today, and they will fall to their true economic value, which is their value when the externality of carbon emissions is priced appropriately. The value of time is at the heart of risk management, from financial markets to climate change. Whether it is financial risk management or trying to address environmental problems, time matters. With sufficient time, any problem can be solved. Risk management only really gets interesting and becomes essential when you have a time constraint. Indeed, time is at the heart of a model that I helped to build to estimate the appropriate price of climate risk. With enough time and appropriate incentives in place, things almost always turn out fine, and that's what we should expect. But the second fundamental component of the model is an appreciation for the underlying risks and uncertainties. Many factors, such as the distribution of future climate impacts and how they depend on current emissions, are fundamentally uncertain. The key uncertainty, and the one that leads to a higher price on carbon, is around climate science itself. To be clear, there's a lot that science does know. It is virtually certain that the planet is warming as a result of burning fossil fuels. However, it is nonetheless still true that the science gives us a wide range of estimates of how bad the future damages might be. This uncertainty arises in part because of uncertainty in the climate models themselves, attempting to capture inherently uncertain processes like climate feedback effects. Add to that the inherent uncertainties of how humans will react to rising sea levels, increasingly intense hurricanes, and changing precipitation patterns. In the end, it comes down to a race between climate damages and human ingenuity to try to avoid them and adapt to them. Both are uncertain. The question is, which uncertainty is more consequential? And how should we deal with this uncertainty? Well, we need to buy insurance against the potential worst-case scenarios. Practically, that means pricing carbon emissions. Now, our model puts the optimal price at about $100 per ton of carbon dioxide emitted today, or about $1 per gallon of gasoline. That seems like a large number, and it is, and it isn't. It is larger than most estimates that don't focus on uncertainty as a key driver of pricing emissions. But it isn't, because that money clearly isn't lost to the economy. Revenue raised could be used to reduce other taxes, stimulating economic activity in the process. It will also signal the path that society will take to reduce climate risk. And by reducing uncertainty about that path, it will stimulate investment. Failing to price carbon comes at a very serious cost to society. I want to talk for a minute about the urgency of pricing carbon and about the cost of delay. Our model estimates the cost of delay by looking at how much would you have to increase consumption in order to make society as well off when emissions pricing is delayed as without any delay. For example, in our model, delaying implementation of carbon pricing by only 1 year costs society about $900 billion, or about 2% of total global consumption. Moreover, because we're wasting a scarce resource, the cost of that delay grows with the square of time. A 5-year delay, for example, creates the equivalent loss of well-being of a 10% loss in consumption for 5 years, about $24 trillion, which is comparable to a severe global recession, or depression, actually, 10% consumption loss over 5 years. Now, while there's plenty of uncertainty in this kind of an estimate, there's no question that emissions should be priced immediately and that the deadweight cost of additional delay is large and grows rapidly. No one knows what the capacity of the atmosphere is to safely absorb emissions. No one can possibly know where that first tipping point is that will lead to a catastrophic outcome. If anything, it's precisely that uncertainty itself that increases the optimal price of carbon. Now, I recently joined the board of the Climate Leadership Council, an initiative led by elder statesmen of the Republican Party, Jim Baker and George Shultz, among others. This initiative, sometimes known as the conservative case for a carbon dividend, also includes many of the largest businesses in the world, including Exxon, Shell, BP, and Total, as well as Johnson & Johnson, Unilever, GM, and many others. It includes support from many economists and business leaders on both sides of the political spectrum. And the initiative is gaining support rapidly. You may have heard even just yesterday an announcement about support from 33 student groups at colleges across the country, primarily young Republican clubs, but also those of Democrats and environmentalists. And we plan to make sure that you will be hearing much more about our proposal in the months ahead. We call it a carbon dividend plan because it would place a tax on carbon emissions and give 100% of the revenues back to citizens on a per capita basis. It would also roll back other expensive and unnecessary regulatory efforts to reduce emissions, and it would provide liability protection to corporations for historical emissions, which is why the fossil fuel industry supports it. Models show that approximately 70% of U.S. citizens with the lowest incomes would be made better off, that the dividend would more than cover the increased costs for those individuals, the costs that they would face in the markets. Of course, the legislative process is highly uncertain, and there are many other proposals out there. The different proposals differ primarily in how the revenues from a carbon tax would be used. As an economist, I'm concerned about creating the right incentives, not about how the money is spent. I think the CLC, the Climate Leadership Council, proposal happens to sit in a sweet spot of political realities. We need to get the support of at least 12 Republican senators, and I think we can do that. In any case, if our proposal helps to start a debate, I think the realities will speak for themselves, and we will get to a significant carbon tax, although it may not look at all like our proposal. Again, let me emphasize that not pricing carbon emissions is a serious bug in the U.S. tax code. I thought the tax reform effort led by Republicans last year would have been a perfect opportunity to create appropriate incentives and significantly reduce budget deficits, and I tried hard during that debate to make myself heard. Sadly, even though many Republicans understand this reality, in the Senate, not one was willing to speak out. The reasons, unfortunately, are well understood. Now, I understand there was a promise from the Republican leadership that they would allow a carbon tax to be discussed at some point this year. But this political environment obviously doesn't make the chances for policy sound very optimistic. However, I think the political realities are changing rapidly. There are plenty of signs. For example, last year at its annual general meeting, Exxon's management was slapped hard by shareholders who voted 62% against management's recommendation that they accept its previous statements on the implications of climate risk, including a report that minimized the danger and deliberately and wildly exaggerated the costs of addressing climate change. As another example, recently Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock, the largest holder of index assets, announced that BlackRock would be engaging corporations on the environmental and social sustainability of their business plans. Just yesterday, a Chevron director tweeted, this was amazing, I don't know if you saw this, quote, if energy consumption is declining and renewable energy consumption is on the rise, and she referenced evidence that this is indeed the case, then what does that mean for the future of the oil industry? By the way, that tweet was taken down within 5 hours. But I'll tell you what, I agree with this director. Chevron is what I would call a stranded asset, particularly when we price in the externality of emissions. Now, numerous investors around the world have announced divestment of fossil fuels or plans for future engagement with fossil fuel companies. Many municipalities have announced lawsuits against fossil fuel companies demanding payments for costs that have or will be incurred in addressing the impacts of climate change. No one knows when or how an opportunity to address climate risk will take place. There is a move to fund infrastructure investment this year, and although I think that legislation is unlikely to move forward, if it does, it would be a perfect opportunity. It would make sense to fund infrastructure through a carbon tax or a gas tax. In either case, you solve two problems beautifully. You fund infrastructure and you address climate risk. Now, at the end of the day, though, most people remain very pessimistic about the passage of a federal carbon tax. And although I would have to admit, I do not see the scenario where a carbon tax makes its way into legislation this year, I nonetheless remain optimistic about its prospects in the future. And let me tell you why. When people see the situation as hopeless, they tend to be passive. And that's where we are today with respect to climate policy. But once they see others visibly taking a stand, they become willing to act themselves. This creates positive feedback and more people speak out. We saw this play out with respect to marriage equality recently. It was impossible just before it became inevitable. And right now we're seeing a similar dynamic, maybe playing out with respect to gun violence. And in this context, notice that businesses are playing a leading role. I think that makes sense. In many cases, businesses will lead and governance will follow. And I hope and expect this dynamic will play out soon with respect to appropriate pricing of greenhouse gas emissions. And I expect that this dynamic will include a very significant role from business leaders. Every politician I've talked to understands the need to act. At least they say so in the privacy of their own offices. But they also say they need cover to speak out publicly. Cover in this context comes from courageous citizens in their own districts speaking out and starting the conversation. So as a risk manager, my one message to you is this. Please speak out whenever you can on behalf of the urgency to address the risk of climate change. And as business executives, please emphasize the importance of creating appropriate incentives through a carbon tax. Positive impacts will be unleashed rapidly when governments create appropriate incentives to reduce emissions and otherwise allow the market system to work its magic. The clock is ticking and still we have no carbon tax. Thank you, and I'm ready to take questions.
Thanks a lot, Bob. Again, if you're interested in asking a question, you can email it to us at info@businessfwd.org, or you can press 1 on your dial pad and ask the question live. Our first question is by email, and it's from Maria Gonzalez in Houston, Texas. And she asks about how do you account for a carbon tax with imports and exports, and how do we avoid our businesses becoming less competitive as a result of the tax?
Sure, that's a good question. In the context of the Climate Leadership Council, we have four pillars, and one of those is to have import taxes on products where they come from a country that does not include a comparable tax. So if you have energy-sensitive imports that are cheaper because they come from a country where there's no tax, the idea would be to add an import tax on them. And that's something that, you know, is a little bit tricky, but it's clearly necessary in order to protect domestic manufacturers.
We have a question from Russell Riggs. Russell, you are now live.
Well, first of all, I appreciate your optimism about perhaps this might something in this area might get done eventually. But I guess my question is, when you have the political leadership questioning all of these issues, how do you overcome the political dynamics that are in play right now?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm not an expert on political science, but again, first of all, the climate leadership, so I think the political reality is that we need to get Republican support, and there are issues, some people would emphasize them, getting some of the Democrats and environmental organizations to support a market-based, you know, approach that relies on creating appropriate incentives. But I think the reality is that the Democrats would almost all support this at the end of the day. At the Climate Leadership Council, we are trying to create a balance between the incentive, which really should be much higher than will be politically realistic. So something on the order, I mentioned that I have a model that says the optimal price is, above $100 a ton. That's just not going to happen. But if we can get to $40 a ton, that's a lot better than zero. Or frankly, right now, when you take into account incentives to, produce and consume fossil fuels, which are typically much higher around the world than they are in the U.S., but nonetheless, we do have tax incentives supporting fossil fuels today. We've got our foot on the accelerator, and we need to be pressing on the brake. And braking at $40 a ton is a lot better than continuing to accelerate. So how do we get there? Well, we have to get Republicans on board, I think, at the end of the day. And the way to get Republicans on board is to get industry, businesses, to support it. And that's why the Climate Leadership Council started by saying, what do we need to do to bring fossil fuel companies to the table? And the answer really is we need to provide some bit of certainty about where the emissions price would go, and we have to give the industry something that it would take in exchange for supporting a tax. And what is going to make it worthwhile to them, frankly, is protection against liability. And so that's part of our approach. This isn't about penalizing the fossil fuel industry. This is about creating appropriate incentives for society. And so I think it makes sense to find that kind of a compromise where if we can get industry on board, and we have tremendous support, as I mentioned earlier, from big companies in many sectors of the economy, I think that will get us to a place where at least we can start talking about this and remove the sort of tribal chasm between Republicans and Democrats and start a conversation where, as I say, when you talk to these folks in the privacy of their office, they know this is a problem. But, you know, there, I would say there is not the same appreciation of the urgency of this problem. So that's one problem. But, you know, let's push the kick the can down the road, because it's very painful for me to say anything publicly, because, you know, historically there's been a lot of money available to block action on this. I think that money, the funding of those efforts is drying up. You know, again, you look at the Exxon meeting last year where 62% of shareholders voted against management. That's very significant. The directors of Exxon are not ignoring that. And they would like to see a path forward. So I think that that support from businesses is really key. I think we can get, once a conversation is going, I think that provides the cover. There's a Democratic Senator, Sheldon Whitehouse, from Rhode Island, who really has been a leader on this effort from the Democratic side, of course. But his view, and I think he's probably right, is that the Republicans are in jail. They would like to get out. They don't see the future of the Republican Party as being in climate denial. But, you know, how do we get them out of jail? How do we provide that cover? I'm not sure how that happens. But, you know, I think the hurricanes, the flooding that we saw this year in Houston, you know, people, the sea level rise that you're seeing already in Florida and all along the coasts, these are things that people are starting to get very concerned about. And once we have a debate and a conversation, I think it'll be pretty clear that we should have appropriate incentives to reduce emissions. You know, perhaps I'm being optimistic in part because of my background in risk management on Wall Street. But, you know, a risk management problem is an urgent problem. When I was at Goldman Sachs, it was inconceivable that we would raise a risk issue and have someone say, well, let's address it next week. A risk issue is always a priority because you don't know how much time you have. You want to address it. I sit on the board of the Options Clearing Corp. It's what's called a SIFMU, a systemically important financial market utility. We have to maintain a clearing fund that will cover, you know, the two defaults of our two top, you know, counterparties in an extreme event, an 87 kind of crash event. You know, whether that's $10 billion or $14 billion, or, you know, who knows what the right number is, but at least we think about it. You know, with respect to climate risk, it's like our head is in the sand. We're totally ignoring this issue, and we're filling up a reservoir. It's just, to me, it's inconceivable, and it's going to end, like I say, it's like marriage inequality. It looks impossible until you confront it and you say, well, of course we should be creating appropriate incentives to reduce emissions. It's insane not to be doing that. So, you know, I'm optimistic because I come from this background in risk management, and it's just what we're doing is completely insane. I don't know if that helps.
Our next question is from Tina Greco in San Diego, and she has a question about the cost of time reference that you made. What's the math with 1 year delay versus a 5 year delay? Could you just walk us through that math again, Bob?
Yeah, well, okay, so first of all, you have to have a model to do this kind of analysis, and let me emphasize that any model is an approximation of reality. There's a lot of uncertainty in these models, and, you know, rather than defend these models as being very accurate, let me say they're a stab in the dark, but that uncertainty only raises the price. If you're not sure about your estimate, you've got to err on the side of caution. Now, having said that, what we do is we look at, you know, what does an optimal policy look like, taking into account the fact that you're going to learn over time a lot of information. You're going to learn about the elasticity of the demand for fossil fuels versus clean energy. You're going to learn about the fragility of the environment. You're going to learn about technology. I mean, you're going to learn a lot going forward. And so then you ask yourself, well, let's compare how well off we estimate society is going to be in terms of its future consumption and climate-related damages if we price emissions immediately versus if we price emissions with some delay. Now, when you price emissions with a delay, you use up, you know, some of that remaining capacity in the reservoir, which is the Earth's atmosphere. Because you're wasting that capacity rather than using it optimally, you're worse off. And the question is, how much worse off are you? And the way we answer that question is we say, in the context of a model, how much additional consumption do we have to give you during that first period in order to make your utility equal to that you would have had we immediately priced emissions? And the answer is, if we wait 1 year, then you would have to compensate society with approximately 2% of consumption, 2% of additional consumption, to make it as well off. Now, that's a huge number. 2% of consumption for a year is a lot of money, and that's the cost of 1 year delay. But now, let's say we make it a 2 year delay. It's not that you have to compensate for 2% of consumption for 2 years. Rather, it's 4% of consumption for 2 years. So the cost is growing with the square of time. And if it's 5 years, it's 10% of consumption for 5 years. So, and why is it growing more than linearly? The answer is because we're using up an unknown amount of the remaining capacity of the atmosphere. And so the longer you wait, it's not just a linear thing, because you've got that much less capacity, whatever you had, and you don't know. It's all uncertain. So basically, this is a problem that is exploding on us in terms of the expected damages, and we don't know how much time we have, and that's why I say it's exploding. We don't know. It could be that the tipping point is 30 years off in the future, or it could be the tipping point is 2 years off in the future, or it could be, you know, we already passed it. It's too late. We just don't know, and we won't know. That will be revealed over time. And as I said, it's just, it's so uncertain because, yes, there's going to be new technologies that we can't imagine. And, yes, we will adapt. We will spend money to harden our infrastructure. We will build seawalls where we can, et cetera, et cetera. But why are we taking this risk? We already know. You know, this year alone, there were $200 billion worth of damages coming from those hurricanes, the flooding, the wildfires. Now, you can't attribute all of that to climate change, but the science of extreme weather attribution is allowing us to push those attributions more and more, at least in a probabilistic sense. We can certainly say the flooding in Houston was, you know, whatever, two or three times more likely because of climate change. We can certainly say the strength of the hurricanes, the probability of wildfires. These things are all increasing because of the changes that we're making to the atmosphere. And so some large percentage of those damages is now being attributed to climate change. And we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars in this country in 1 year. So you can imagine, when you think about globally and increasing damages, that there are trillions of dollars of damages coming at us in an expected sense. We don't really know what the reality is going to be or the outcome is going to be, but we're creating a tremendous amount of risk. Now, there's nothing we can do about the historical emissions. that's done. But what we can do is we can address the emissions that we create going forward. And so that's when we talk about 2% of consumption or 10% of consumption, we're talking about the cost of not pricing emissions over the next so many years. It just doesn't make any sense. This is something that we can control. These future damages, if we don't price emissions, are our own fault. So that's how to think about it. This is an urgent problem. I like to tell people it's time to slam on the brakes. We have a problem coming at us that we don't know how serious it is, but we have to think about worst-case scenarios, and we have to recognize when you're managing risk, you don't know how much time you have. You can't afford to waste time. Now, the good news is we know how to fix it. It's a bug in the tax code. It costs us nothing to fix this bug. It's just political will.
We've got a couple questions that relate to environmental justice, Bob. And one of the questions is from Ramesh Martin from Nashville, Tennessee. And it relates to the current incentives encourage more pollution in poor communities. Would a carbon tax help adjust that? So, for example, in New York, people in the South Bronx have the quality of air is significantly worse than in other parts of the New York metro region. Is there any implications for a carbon tax on that kind of disparity?
Well, you know, I would put it this way. I sympathize with those who are being impacted the most by these climate damages, and it's certainly is worse in poorer communities. But I would say, first of all, it's much worse in countries around the world than it is in the U.S. The U.S. has a much stronger infrastructure, and even in our poorer communities in the U.S., they're not hit nearly as hard as many poorer communities around the world. But I would say that the problem of creating appropriate incentives to reduce emissions needs to be separated from the problem of environmental justice. And you know, one could say that we should use the revenues from a carbon tax to help clean up these poorer communities or communities that have disproportionately suffered. But I would say it's best to separate those two issues. You know, in I think it was Washington State, they had a carbon tax proposal, and virtually none of the environmental folks out there NGOs and so on supported it. And it was because they weren't comfortable with how the revenues were going to be used. You know, I think it's a big mistake to fight over the revenues from a particular piece of legislation. What's really important is that we create the right incentives to reduce emissions, and it's also important that we address, you know, income inequality and environmental justice, but they're separate issues. And the one is a risk management crisis that needs to be addressed immediately, and the other is a long-term problem that we're not going to solve overnight. And so while I have a lot of sympathy for the issues of environmental justice, I think we have to separate those issues and not, you know, now politically there may be a compromise there that can address both. And in fact, that's probably the reality. But, you know, as an economist and a risk management expert, I'm focused on creating the right incentives, and, you know, how we use those revenues is something that I think needs to be part of the political process.
Our next question is from Muntaha Haddad from Gaithersburg, Maryland. You are on the line.
Hi, thank you. Thanks, Robert. It's really a pleasure to hear you speak about the urgency of carbon emissions taxes or assessment on thereof. My main concern is this. You had mentioned that in order for the viability of emissions to work in our favor and to reduce the carbon emissions, that you would consider, or you're putting forth a proposal for which an excess tax would be imposed, $1 per gallon, is that, and $100 per ton.
Mm-hmm.
Are you suggesting that this is going to be imposed on corporations, or is this coming out of the general consumer's budget? In
well,
other words, are the citizens paying for this? And that's one question, one part of the question. The other part is this. Had you considered all of this proposal prior to the current tax reduction that was given to U.S. corporations? Because I see that with a 14% corporate tax deduction countrywide, before the tax had gone through, we could have actually allocated or earmarked a percentage for tax emissions, carbon assessment and tax emissions.
Okay, sure. So first of all, who pays for it? Well, in the Climate Leadership Council proposal, it would be assessed at basically as close to the source of the fossil fuels as possible, you know, at the coal mines, at the refineries, and maybe at the pipeline for natural gas. But the point is, whoever pays it, whether it, let's say it's the oil companies at their refineries that are paying the tax, it's going to be passed on. So it will be built into the cost of all goods and services in the country as is appropriate, you know, on the basis of the amount of greenhouse gases that are, you know, going to be created when that oil or coal or whatever is burned. And that will create the appropriate incentives. You know, the beauty of using incentives is that the ultimate consumer doesn't even have to know that it's built in. You know, they say there's a lot of carbon emissions built into beef, that a cow creates just as much carbon dioxide or greenhouse gas, is actually what they create is methane, but as much greenhouse gas as a car. Well, you know, what is that per pound of steak? I have no idea. But the point being that when you build the costs appropriately into the prices, then the consumer will make the right decision totally unconsciously. You know, it's kind of like a force, kind of like gravity. And when it's not there, or let's say it's got the wrong force. So with respect to carbon right now, there's actually government tax incentives that increase the likelihood that we'll create emissions relative to a totally level playing field. And all I'm saying is we ought to create the right incentives, and the easiest way to do that is to price fuel as close to the source. There'd probably be about 2,000 places where you would have to impose that tax if you do it the way I'm suggesting. And in most cases, that data, in other words, the amount of oil that's being produced, et cetera, it's already being collected. So it's not a big data collection problem. You're not imposing a lot of tax collection. There's not a lot of costs associated with it. And yet, it would build into the prices of all goods and services the appropriate costs, and therefore it would create the right incentives ultimately for, as I said, consumers, businesses, entrepreneurs, investors. Everyone would be making the right decisions. So you could say ultimately it's paid for by consumers, but it's really creating appropriate incentives for everybody. And most people would be better off in the context of the Climate Leadership Council, because we'd be giving a dividend of about $500 per person, or say $2,000 per family. And for most people, that would be more income from that dividend than they would be ultimately paying through the increased costs of the goods and services that they buy. And in fact, I would argue that removing the uncertainty of which way this economy is going to go in the future, we're going to go to a low-carbon future, and the sooner that we create those signals, that's going to unleash investment. That'll tell us, which kind of investments are going to make sense in the future. And the sooner we do that, the better. Well, I was going to say there was a second question, which is, did we consider this prior to tax reform? And, from last year, absolutely. The Climate Leadership Council got started in, I think it was January of 17, and it very much would have made sense to have a carbon tax be part of that reform. It made so much sense. I was so disappointed that the Republicans were unwilling to address it, and that's what happened. And so we got corporate tax reform without paying for it, and the right way to pay for it would have been to include a carbon tax. It is, at the end of the day, a bug in the tax code that we're not creating appropriate incentives to reduce emissions. It's pretty simple.
Bob, one point to reiterate in your previous answer, because we get a lot of questions about it. In terms of where the taxes are levied, they're levied at the mine or at the pump and at the port if you're importing fuels. So as you said, it could be just a few thousand entities that actually are taxed, and then they pass those taxes on to consumers to the price of their goods. So in terms
right.
of feasibility, it's actually it's the information, as you said, is already being collected. The number of people to be taxed is quite small compared to other taxes. With that, I think this is we have time for just one more question. We have a question from Chuck Tollefson from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and his question is, would it be better to have tax credits rather than a tax?
Well, the problem with credits is that if I understand what you mean by a credit, the government is then determining who to give the credit to. It's picking a technology or a research or whatever it's crediting and saying, here's an incentive for you. Well, the problem with that is, we don't know what the right technology is or the right approach. We should let the markets and entrepreneurs and investors take those risks and make those decisions. The use of tax dollars, first of all, we don't have a lot of extra tax dollars to give credits for, so it costs the government, and we don't have the resources to do that. And secondly, it's just inefficient. We don't want governments making those decisions. We want to create the incentive to reduce emissions. And I usually say the appropriate incentive to reduce emissions. No one knows what the appropriate incentive is. Right now, as I said, the political reality is probably a tax on the order of something like $40 a ton. Probably is what's in the sweet spot, because there's so much uncertainty. As a risk manager, the way I think about the problem is, what's the lowest price that would allow me to be very confident we're going to solve that problem? And I think that is the right way to think about it. And I'm not sure $40 a ton is going to do it. Now, it's going to be a lot better than zero or a negative number with the current incentives. But, it's hard to be confident that $40 is enough, and that kind of uncertainty actually means the price is higher. Having said that, I think that's kind of the range, at least to start, that is politically feasible right now. You have conflicting, I would say, interests in creating a path for the expected future price, which is something that businesses find to be very helpful in making long-run investment decisions. Give me a sense of where you think this price is going to go. And I understand that. But on the other hand, as I mentioned before, this is really kind of an optimal control problem, and you need to react to new information. And so, when you get into the weeds of these proposals, including the Climate Leadership Council, you're going to have some sort of compromise between specifying a starting price, a rate of escalation of that price, of that tax, versus being able to be flexible and either recognizing that, let's say, technology develops more quickly than we thought, or maybe the environment is more robust than we worried about, and therefore the price doesn't have to go up as fast. And on the other hand, maybe things are much worse, and therefore the price really should escalate much more quickly. And the way to do that is to create some sort of target emissions reductions. And then if you're meeting your targets, fine. If you're not meeting your targets, you build in an escalation process. So that's part of the complexity of this kind of legislation and part of what we're dealing with at the Climate Leadership Council.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you also to the Partnership for Responsible Growth who helped organize this. That's all the time we have for today. Please check your email for a post-event survey where you can let us know what you thought of today's call. If you've got questions, and we have a number of people who had, were hoping to ask questions, but we ran out of time, please email the question to us at info@businessfwd.org, and we'll do our best to answer them. And if you are interested in learning more about this, we can send you further resources and put you in touch with the CLC and with Partnership for Responsible Growth. Thank you, Bob, for joining us, and we're going to we'll be updating you with calls on this topic in the coming weeks. And have a great day. Thank you.